you can do it better than I can.
Sorry, for the first time in that English.
So can you hear the microphone?
What?
I think we can hear it.
Now?
Well,
something
happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so first of all, thank you for inviting me to talk here today. So today I'm going to make a review, a summary of some recent work which I've done with many people in the past year. So it's mostly with James Parks, all of the papers which appeared here, and then with other people which can read. Benvenuti, Franco, Jerome Gonsett, Hanani, Dan Walter, and recently with Yap. Okay, so I will be talking about ABS-CFT, fortunately not about cosmology or phenomenology, which we have many nice talks recently here. But I hope to convince you that it's still an interesting topic. So we have learned many things thanks to the ABS-CFT correspondence in recent years. And it's the best realization of the idea of holography which we have. And it's a very concrete realization of that. So the basic example, which is originally used in Magasina, where you take any three brains and put in flat space. Then, because on the brains you have superlinear means living on them, you can take the vector-active geometry, which gives rise to it is 5 versus 5, and then the duality says that the vector geometry is 5 versus 5, and the n plus 4 superlinear means are in fact dual. So the basic idea is now that instead of putting the brains in flat space, we put the brains transverse to some Calabi-Yau space in matrix direction here, and we do this because we want to preserve some supersymmetry. So if this happens, and in addition, we take this Calabi-Yau to be a cone, will be necessarily singular, it's not the flat space. And it will give, after the vector action is included, it will give a geometry which is 8 is 5 across some 5 dimensional manifold, which you may take as your definition of Sasaki-Einstein manifold. So that's the motivation for studying Sasaki-Einstein geometry in the context of ABS-CFT and also beyond that. That should be our motivation. So whenever you have a geometry like this, where it's like Y5 is Sasaki-Einstein, it's a supersymmetric solution of type 2D, and therefore I'll give you some examples of it of ABS-CFT. So the example that many people know, in fact, is given by the conical theory, which was worked out by Fassman and Witten some time ago. And if you forget about the case of SPI, which is the better understood case, that's basically the only non-trivial example of exactly conformal theory duality we had in this context. So let me remind you briefly what are the features of this example, because the example that I will discuss later are generalizations of this, so non-trivial generalizations of this. So the dual theory is, in this case, an n plus 1 systematic quiver-gauge theory with only two gauge groups. So these nodes represent S-rank gauge groups. And there are bifundamental fields, AI and EI, stretching these two gauge groups. And also, so the geometry of the Sasaki-Einstein manifold, which in this case is the so-called T11 manifold, to give you many information, gives you many information about the field theory itself. So for instance, there is a one isometry, which corresponds to the R symmetry. Then there is a quite large group of isometries, SU2 to SU2, which gives rise to some flavor symmetry, on which this case is take value. And then also from the topology, we can also deduce that there is a baryonic system, which comes from reducing the full form on this three side. And then, for instance, you can compute exactly the central charge of this theory and its infrared fixed points, just computing the volume of this guy, essentially, and using this formula, and it gives you this number. So these are examples of what you can do, given the geometry. In addition, the superpotential can be written down essentially in a unique way, given these symmetries which I told. So the bottom line of this transparency is that thanks to the ADS-CFT correspondence, every Sasaki-Essen geometry can be interpreted in terms of some specific gauge theories. And we can learn, hopefully, a lot about this for one specific theories just in terms of this geometry. And of course, vice versa. So this is exactly what happened when we studied with Yao these properties of Sasaki-Essen manifold. We just wanted to see what's the realization in the geometry of a field theory phenomenon, which I will describe later. So it would be nice to have more examples apart from this one. But unfortunately, until recently, there weren't any examples. And this is just a brief history of Sasaki-Essen geometry in the context of ADS-CFT, so that you can see more or less what happened. So it took about 10 years from the when this guy showed the existence of this metric, and when this metric was essentially understood completely in the context of the confold by Kandel and Delahosse, and then another 10 years before Kellerman and Wooten worked out the gauge theory. Of course, there wasn't any ADS-CFT correspondence, so I'm not blaming them taking so long. And then it took another 6 years, basically, in this example here, T1-1, where the story was complete. And this took place in the last year. We essentially discovered this matrix, YPQ. Then later on, with James Parks, we described this LRBAUS and discovered the Delacroix. We'll explain what this means later. And then immediately afterwards, it was easy to find out the gauge theory, given these results. So we are now from one example to an infinite class of examples, and this should be sounds like an interesting progress. So this represents somehow the plan of the talk in a sort of loop way. So we I discussed the magic first of all very briefly because of lack of time, and then I'll show how you can construct this LRBAUS, and then from there you can construct this moment map, which I'll discuss, and find out about the toric singularities. Then construct the Quiver gauge theory of this. Then apply this technique of Hegel maximization due to intermediate random depth to find out the charges, so the R charges and the central charges in theory. And then finally, by using this ADS-CFT formula which I've shown before about volumes, for instance, one can show that in fact these charges which are computed here. And as you see, the highly non-trivial formulas, I mean, they're not just numbers as for the conifold, and simple numbers as I've just shown to you. They're more complicated. So you have to compare this number here.
So what is n dependent on
n? I'm suppressing any factor of n, n is the unit of flux. From our own fire.
A is actually.
This is multiplied by some power of n.
Well, just one more.
I think it's n. Yeah. Yeah, but this is, well, it's always going to be true. So you just put n to 1. The dependence on n is trivial. Okay, so we'll see that, in fact, these two coefficients match. And this last part of the story, the A maximization part, led to these few results on the geometry of the Sasaki-Essen manifold, on which I will comment, hopefully, by the time again. Right. Okay. So this is a very short summary of the matrix, the matrix which I found together with the as far as I'm welcome. So I'll spare you all the details of the derivation and all the discussion of these metrics. And I just want to write down the metric for you here once. So you see it's a five-dimensional metric. You can check that at least. And it's parameterized by two non-trivial functions which I haven't written down, which depend on this coordinates y, which is here. and also on some constant A, which is crucially discretized. So it depends on some integer parameters through this formula here, and also there's another constant which similarly depends on these numbers B and Q.
What do you mean by irregular metrics?
That's a good question, which I'll ask answer. Let's see. Oh, in fact, yeah, I'm sorry, it happened something. I had to make a transparency when explaining this. So let me just go back and put this transparency. Something happened with my transparency here. So yeah, to appreciate what I was talking about, perhaps it's best if I recall these definitions. Thanks. Okay, so it's a psychological geometry. Here is summarized very briefly. So it's given, so we'll be concerned with five-dimensional matrix, although this exists in all dimensions. So essentially, the most interesting object in this geometry is the existence of this feeling vector, which is called greed, and which I'll mention many times later, and which has unit norm. And if you take the dual with the metric, you have a one form, which gives rise to a two form, basically derivative. So now, locally, every Schwarzschild state metric, you can write down this form, where essentially you have this killing vector direction, and transverse to that, there's a four-dimensional slice, which is locally Kähler Einstein. So the metric is this metric here, so it's Kähler and Einstein. However, it's important that, in fact, globally, this object here is not well-defined in general. So there are three cases. So if you have heard about Sasaki-Einstein geometry, you probably have heard about this case here, which is called regular case, in which this part here is a manifold. So you can equivalently see the full manifold as a U1 principal bundle over this Kähler-Einstein space. So for instance, for the conifold, the Kähler-Einstein space is just as 2 plus 2. This case is essentially the same, where you now replace the manifold with the normifold, and irregular, in fact, means that this part here is not globally defined. Or equivalently, the orbits of the scaling vector here don't close, so you can just go around in a torus forever. Okay, so it's important to emphasize that all of these cases, for all of these cases, the five-dimensional metric is always the smooth manifold. So don't be confused if I say irregular or quasi regular. It's always going to be a manifold in five dimensions. This is just a useful way to distinguish it. So this might seem to you like a strange case to consider, something which is just sick. But in fact, if you pick a random Schwarzschild metric, it's going to fall in this case. So the regular case is essentially the important matrix, such as zero measure in the space of all Schwarzschild geometries. And of course, to go back to my previous transparency, the examples that we constructed fall precisely into this class of irregular ones. Okay, so in this way, they are non-trivial.
Question? Is it Sasaki-Einstein this manifold defined only on five dimensions?
No, I just mentioned that in fact it's defined on all odd dimensions. And we also.
Kähler-Einstein is this U1.
Sorry, can I make a point?
So it's always involved Kähler-Einstein of the one lower dimension?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You can always do the same sort of classifications.
And the regular ones always exist in either one dimension as well.
Yeah. In fact, I should point out that the irregular cases, they weren't shown to exist. I mean, there weren't any existing theorem or examples until we found this method. So they just existed in principle. Okay, so we found these metrics in five dimensions, and later on, we found, in fact, in all dimensions. I'm not going to discuss this today, but there is a similar story for all dimensions, particularly there is a similar story in seven dimensions, which is useful for entering. Okay, so, yeah. So one shows that these parameters A and L, probably L, must be discretized, must depend on these numbers P and Q, which are related to certain CERN numbers, if you view this metric as some vibration. So what are the important properties of these metrics? Well, so here is a very short summary. So there is a summary isometry, which is given by this proof. The topology is always given by S2 plus S3, exactly as for the conifold. so independently of P and Q, so long as they're proper. And also is a canonical spin vector can be given as a linear combination of vector derivatives. Okay, so this is important because I can anticipate that this is dual to the R symmetry direction in the gauge theory. If you compute the volume and the metric, it's pretty trivial, and you find this expression, which is slightly unpleasant, and you think there's something perhaps going on is wrong, until then finally you find a case where you are, it works. Okay. Yes?
I don't want to preview too much, but isn't generically all isometries of the transverse manifold become global symmetries in the dual gauge theory? So what happens to the other isometries?
Okay, so of this one, so a U1 becomes the R symmetry, which is this one.
Okay.
And the remaining one, roughly, S2 plus U1, becomes a global symmetry. Yes.
So
the flame model, non-R global symmetry.
So how then do you know that this one is precisely the R symmetry?
Oh, that's okay. This will be explained later on in the our talk. However, essentially, you know that because in the geometry, it's the direction under which the spinors are charged. That's essentially why it's true in supergravity. Okay, so I'll start with the tour on the geometry of Calabi-Yau cones and the toric cases, which is going to be a little bit technical, but it's quite easy and it's important in order to finally arrive at the gauge theory. So given a metric, you wouldn't know how to find out what it is. Okay, so given this metric, you just plug in into this formula here and get a metric cone, and this is more or less by definition a Calabi-Yau. So you can translate, you can take this data which you have on the five-dimensional manifold, and by just inserting into these two formulas here, you get the complete data of the Calabi-Yau. So then you get a two form, which is the 1.1 form, okay, or equivalent to the complex structure, if you write one index, and also this 3.0 form of the Calabi-Yau. Of course, these two objects are closed by construction. Okay, so what can you do with these two objects? Well, you can do some nice things. For instance, in particular, if you take the scalar form, you can find out about the divisors of the Calabi-Yau, which are complex scalar submanifolds. Okay, so essentially, because this form is the calibration form for those four manifolds, we find out that there are some supersymmetric cycles, which are in fact cone themselves, so they are little cone into the big cone, which are four-dimensional, so they have a three-dimensional base, and these three-dimensional submanifolds are sitting inside here, and are important because you can wrap in three brains, and these are correspond to a variant in the gauge theory. So you can compute the volumes, for instance, one of these cycles, just once you have identified. More interestingly, in fact, you can use this J to find out about the similarity. And to do that, we need to know a little bit of toric symplectic geometry, but not so much, so that even I can do that. And here is the story. So essentially, if you take a manifold which is symplectic, so it has some symplectic form J, and consider a U1 action, given by some vector of, let's take one to begin with, and if it preserves the two form, so that this guy is zero, you can basically introduce this momentum. This is the basic object which you want. Okay, so for every killing vector which does this for you, you introduce one momentum. So in particular, if you can introduce three of them in complex three dimensions, then by definition, your manifold is toric. So this is what it means to be toric in the context of complex geometry. Then you can use some nice results worked out by many, by several mathematicians. So with a classic result due to Feltin, which tells you that if you take a manifold which is compact and you compute the image of the manifold under this momentum, okay, this is always given by some nice polytope in Rn. So for instance, just to say in figures what I'm saying in words, if you take the image of the moment map of CP2, you just take and obtain this nice triangle here. Okay. So, and you can view then CP2 as a T2 fiber over this triangle, where different circles collapse over the edges and at the vertices, both circles of the T2 collapse. So this is a classic result, which is well known in the mass literature. And for us, it's important that there exists a similar result which applies for cones. So now the manifold is not any more compact. In particular, it's singular at the tip, but still the intuition which you have from here still applies. So if you compute the moment map of one of these toric cones, you obtain something which is now infinite, which goes to infinity here in these lines, and it goes to a certain tip, when, and basically this tip corresponds to the tip of the real. So for example, here you have this guy has four faces, which is exactly the thing which we'll find for the white qubits. So this was done in this work with Sparks. So if you rewrite this symplectic form in this way, it's obvious, just from writing it down, that there are exactly three of these killing vectors. They're not phi, psi, and gamma, and they sit inside the isometric group. So you see there's enough room here for three curves to be in. And you take exactly these three curves to be your torus, gives you the manifold, exhibits the manifold as a toric form. And so, so the moment map is given essentially by this anchors here, by construction. So you can compute the image, and here it is. It's this polyhedral cone, which equivalently it's specified by the normals of the faces. So if you just give the normals of the faces, you have given the complete image.
So this one of the one is R symmetry.
It is non-trivially embedded into that. It's right. Not one of these two, in fact. Because in fact, the R symmetry is not a new one.
Yeah. Oh. So it's not.
It's not compact.
No.
So if you take, so there are two U1s there.
Oh.
Okay. So one U1, say, is this one, and the other one is this one, and the R symmetry is
irrational.
Irrational. Yeah. Yeah. This will. Yeah. yeah, in fact, I flashed that here. Let me just remind you. You can see from here. So this is the asymmetry, and it's a combination with this irrational parameter. And it is a basis, psi and gamma. It's a basis of this U1 plus U1. Okay, so this exercise has given us transform information of the YPQ manifold into essentially four vectors in our tree, okay, which I can just, I haven't written down, but I can just list them. It would be like V1 is equal to 1, 0, 0, et cetera, et cetera. So the complete information is encoded somehow amazingly in these four vectors. Of course, you have lost information about the metric, but you don't have to be concerned about that because you have the metric anyway, so that's the non-trivial part of the metric. I mean, you can take any other singularity if you want, but you wouldn't have the metric. So it was good that we had the metric to begin with. That was the non-trivial part. Okay, so for instance, there are nice things which one can read off directly from this diagram. So for instance, the spaces, four spaces, correspond to this two-dimensional submanifold which are supersymmetric. And you can read off also the topology from there, from here, which is just given by some simple combinatorial formula in terms of these vectors. I won't bother you with details. So the last transparency I promise about toric geometry is this one, which I want to put down because it's essentially, this is to make smart bet with the literature on constructing quivers for brains for singularities. So in that literature, people always write down these diagrams. So if you don't know about them at the beginning, it's, they seem like non-trivial diagrams. But in fact, given what I told you, they're quite easy to understand. So let's see. So getting these normals, first of all, you can rephrase the space. You can also view it as a vacuum of a gauge in a sigma model, or in other words, for more mathematically minded people, as a scalar portion. Okay, so these charges P and Q of the manifold, now they are being translated on these charges which appear in the sigma model construction. It's quite interesting. In any case, if you take these four vectors, which I started to list here, okay, and you just plot them, you'll see they land on a plane. And this is generic, because this is true for any Calabi-Yau singularity. So essentially, Calabi-Yau condition tells you that it must end in this plane. And the problem is then reduced to analyzing two-dimensional diagrams. So the reason why we are now in two dimensions, it comes from here. Okay, and so now we can plot, given a P and a Q, say here P is 2 and Q is 1, P is 3 and Q is 1, and so on. You can plot on a two-dimensional plane these endpoints, so these four endpoints here. Okay. Okay, now they're getting close to understanding the finite gauge. Okay, the reason is, one reason is, for instance, the following. You could, in principle, so you see these diagrams are embedded in this toric diagram for the orbital, which is given by this vertices of this bigger triangle. So in principle, you can apply some algorithm which allows you to extract the gauge theory from that, just by removing these points one by one and reducing to this internal diagram, which is the white Q. You can, in principle, work out the gauge theory. However, this is very computationally impractical, and in principle, you could do that for lowest number of p equals to 2 and 3, and then you have to stop. So you need something more general. Okay. So let's analyze more what's going on. So for a start, you can plug these two limits in the diagram. So you can take this point. So this point, in general, just slides into this diagonal here. And you can ask, well, what happens when it goes to its limits, so when it sits here or it sits here in the upper corner. Okay. So these two limits turn out to be known limits. So they are orbifolds. So one is the orbital of just Ck, and the other one is the orbital of the conic. So you learn two non-trivial facts, which are important later for consecutive gauge theory. So we are now accumulating information. Okay, and so we basically can now construct the Kreber gauge theory, but before doing that, I want you to remind very briefly what the Kreber theory is, just for completeness. So it's a supersymmetric theory, so anyone wants symmetry, has a number of gauge groups which are depicted as nodes in this diagram, and then it has a number of button dimensions, which are basically these arrows stretching between the nodes. So we have seen the conical case was the case with only two nodes. This is the case with four nodes. And this corresponds to the theory, which is sitting at the complex cone of the first vector surface. Now, what you do, given such a quick gauge theory, you have some number of D terms, okay, and also some number of F terms, which comes from extremizing superpotential. So the interesting fact is that, in fact, you can show that for certain particular gauge theories of this type, which are, in fact, called toric, you can repackage this F term and D terms together and show that, in fact, the modular space of this theory is, in fact, a toric RF, which comes exactly as one of these killer portions which I discussed respectively. So we want to construct, in fact, and if we have any hope of constructing these fibers, they're going to be on this family, toric fiber fields.
So what term is the N for the UN?
The N?
Yes.
This one. This is just the quiver per se. I mean, this, I'm not terming anything. I'm just putting a theory. I'm taking that theory. I could, in principle, have a different n or n in different nodes. and that's subject to some consistent information and some anomaly consideration. But I'm just saying that you take the simplest case and you have all n are the same, and if you have some conditions which is theory based, you can show that the modular space is a toric variety. So there is some interplay here between this modular space and between the ABS-CFT correspondence, which is basically the Sasaki-Einstein manifold is just the boundary of this toric variety. And well, this is not surprising because ABS-CFT is about holography and boundaries. So the final step in this program was taken in this paper with the group at MIT, and again, it's in parts, where we basically constructed the scripts. So how does it go? As I told you already, this method of partial resolutions, which is not very practical, so you have to come up with something different. And the idea is that we can now extract information separately from the geometry, which is the one we started with. So we have the physisometries, we have the topology, which I've told you, and we have different information which we are now accumulating and we want to use to extract the gauge theory. So another interesting information which you can work out is the number of gauge groups. So the number of gauge groups of your theory is given by this other characteristic of the resolved manifold. So this toric manifold, you can always resolve them, like the contour, meaning that you can grow some two spheres. Okay. In this case, there are three of them. And then you can compute the other characteristic, which is given just by the sum of 50 numbers, and you find out, in this case, it's given by 2p. The reason this is true is essentially, at least the physical reason, there is also some mathematical reason, that each of these two cycles, which appear in this sum, correspond to some cycle where you can wrap between 5 and 7 grades. So you have the number of brains where you leave the open string stretch is given by this sum. So this is known. It's good. And from now on, all this information I told you is essentially some guesswork. So it would be nice to have a machine where you plug in these values, these numbers I told you, and you work out the quiver. As far as I know, it doesn't exist yet. So, well, please, if you have any clue, tell me. But essentially, in generic cases, you have to play around with these different constraints. So the flavor symmetry being non-abelian is a strong constraint, for instance. And also knowledge of these submanifolds, which give rise to baryonic operators, is important information. And to summarize, you have also three cases which are known. So this was an orbifold, this was another orbifold, and this case, Y21, turns out to be exactly the case of the complex cone, which I've just shown here as an example, not casual in fact. So we know that the gauge theory dual to Y21 is exactly this. And that's, again, important information. Now we can come up with some guess, and then finally perform A maximization, check that everything works fine. So here is the way we present this construction. So you start with the orbital case, whose quiver diagram which one can construct simply by using orbital techniques. It's a simple orbital, and then as you can see, it's very symmetric. So essentially you have three types of fields, two of which are doublets, it's double arrows and external legs. And one is types of field with a single, which is this one. Okay, you see, it's very constrained. So there is a number, so the number of gauge groups is 2p, here is 4. The number of fields is 6p. The superpotential you can write down uniquely, just from reducing the one from the covering space. And then you can check that all these various constraints are satisfied. In particular, it's toric by definition, so the modular space is a toric variety. And now you want to do something to deform it a little bit in order to preserve all these symmetries and also this toric property. And this is the recipe to do that. OK, Okay, so it's in three steps. You pick an arrow, you substitute, you remove one doublet, which was going around the loop, and you substitute with a new field, which was physics, which is all physics. Okay, so now these loops here, you see, they are not anymore as the tuning bar. You simply don't have two doublets to make an epsilon tensor. So you have to do something else. So you come up with this, you just remove these legs here, and you join them, if you join them this way, in order to now restore the invariance, restore the pictorial properties, and essentially you have transformed cubic terms, which are three flex in quartic terms. And now this is a local procedure, so you can repeat any of these external flex, and you see that you get, in general, a theory, which I'll show examples in a minute, so the superpotential contains in general cubic and quartic terms. So these are some examples. Unfortunately, the colors are not really clear, I guess, but they're meant to be four different colors. So this is red, the internal are blue, and the external are two other different colors. So this is case rule 3, for 1, you see 4 minus 3 is 1, so the number of these legs is given by this difference. And the lowest, if you repeat the procedure down to q equals to 0, you get this orbital phase, which is again a very symmetric phase. And this has only quartic terms, and you can check explicitly corresponds to take the orbit, the conical, and you make this orbital and it matches. Okay, so to summarize again, so we're starting with the metric. We constructed the Scalabi-Hauss, understood the toric geometry, and constructed the proposal for the equivalence. Of course, you might object that this is still a gap, and there could be something going wrong at some point. So, as I said, there is, as far as I know, only one way to check if this is consistent, and is this A maximization technique, which I'll review now. So what is it? It's a very nice result, which is quite recent as well, more or less at the same time as where the metrics were discovered, and very nicely fits in with the story of the metric. The reason is the following. So you take all four-dimensional mechanical ones of the conformal field theories, you must have canonically one U1 passing. By U1, of course, again, this is floppy because it could be non-compact, but let's say the algebra of this group must contain a U1 factor, which is the one under which the charges, the supercharges are charged, which is formed under this U1. Okay, so given if you know exactly what this R symmetry is, and you know all these exact charges of these fields into the quiver, you can compute these traces. And you plug it in here, and you get this trace anomalies. So the definition of this trace anomalies is schematically given by this expression. So you can compute this A and C once you know the R symmetry. So it's very important to know. However, it's non-trivial to know. So the issue is that if you have other abelian symmetries, so U1 factor, they can mix with this U1R, so you don't know in principle which U1 is the correct one. So this was resolved, in fact, by the results of intricate effect, where they show that the resolution can go as follows. You take the trial symmetry, where you mix with all the possible U1s, which are flavor generators, so then it can be a number of them. And these are some parameters which are a priori real. And then very nicely and very neatly, you can show that if you plug in these values into here, and you get the trial A, and you just maximize it over the space as high, the maximum that when you take, you can show there is always a maximum, and when you take, when you evaluate A at this maximum, you obtain exactly the central charge of the theory. So that's quite nice and amazing. Okay. In addition, if you now plug in here these values which you have obtained at the maximum, these are the exact R symmetry, which you now know for your theory. You see, a byproduct of this very nice result is that in all four-dimensional mechanical one conformal field theories, these charges are always algebraic irrational numbers. Now, this means simply there are roots of some polynomials with integer coefficients. So you see, you start to see a pattern here because the volumes of these manifolds which we found, they involve some square roots. And this goes very nicely together with the fact that sensor charges are given by square roots, or in fact, more in general, just n roots. Okay, so as I said before, the case of the Sasaki-Einstein manifold being irregular is a generic one. And this is the same statement as saying that the case where these charges are irrational is a generic one. So you must be very lucky to maximize this this function here and obtain this S high, which are now rational. You won't get that in general. OK, so now this is quite straightforward to apply this technique to the case of the queries which I constructed. You have to give a parameterization of these hard charges of these fields, given here, which essentially you can obtain by looking at various constraints, beta function as we know, and so on. And here is this function A, okay, which depends on two parameters, x and y. These are the si which I showed before. So you see, it's this function. It's not so difficult to maximize. You just plug into Mathematica. And you see that if you do this exercise and you maximize it and you evaluate at the maximum, you find the central charge. You plug it in here and you find it will produce exactly the same volume. So that's the perhaps most striking result in this story. So they've gone through this loop, starting from the geometry, bothering about constructing the toric quivers and so on. And eventually, when we do this exercise in field theory, which just is due to some tautological cancellation and so on, you see you reproduce exactly these numbers. So that's quite remarkable. In fact, you reproduce even the charges, as I said, not only the central charge, but also the R charges are exactly reproduced, where these are the volumes of the various submanifolds, like just as I mentioned. So more precisely, this is the story about the submanifold. I want just to sketch this quickly. So to every submanifold, which is supersymmetric, three-dimensional submanifold, you can associate some baryonic operator, which corresponds to the three grains, okay, and it's given essentially by some determinant of the five dimensional fields. So you have a number of them, four each for each field there is a baryonic operator, and you can compute the R charges using this formula, which again it's a ABS-CFT formula, and you can match. So you compute the R charges of these various cycles. And match and you obtain this matching on this table. So in fact, the matching is even more precise. You can obtain information about the homology of these cycles and anything fits, but I'll skip this one because I want to discuss now in the last 10 minutes the results about the geometric dual plane maximization. So, okay, so the story of the Whiteman cube matrix and quivers is now here concluded. So if there is any question, it's a good point. Otherwise, I'll go on with the other part.
The R charges of baryonic operators are never integral, never free.
If they are ever rational.
Yeah, it is about kind of numbers.
These are the numbers.
Oh, so not even.
Yes, these are the numbers. And you can, you know, you see, essentially, whenever this quantity is an integer, actually a square integer, sorry, then the numbers are rational. So it's a Diophantine equation which you.
Oh, okay. Sometimes it's not.
Yeah, it's always this combination here, the square roots which appears. The rest are all rational numbers. Yeah. So you might ask, what's special to these theories where this is relevant? Okay. In the paper, we sort of give a number. We list all the possibilities. It's just a number theory exercise.
Can R times two account in less than?
Sorry, say it again.
R charge in the order 2 is along them.
In the limit. In the limit where you
put the order for. Yeah. Yeah, not never to the final.
No, I mean, not 2, not precisely 2. What do you mean by 2? The superpotential has always R charge 2.
Right. Yeah, I'm asking you whether there's a margin.
No, okay, that's not true. No, I didn't mean in the limits they go to some fractional numbers like 1/2, say, and then you recover. So in the limit of the conical, each of them has R charge 1/2. So that the quality has 2 the quality terms.
Have you looked at the Lusignan spectrum? That you guys are looking at?
No, we haven't.
UBS operators.
We haven't looked at all. I think it's a very interesting question. It is as not easy as I guess the Gaussian spectrum. So although I'm not really into that field, but you know, when you have a Gaussian space, there are techniques to obtain the spectrum purely in terms of group theory. This is not the case for our spaces, so you have to do something more, either more sophisticated or less sophisticated, just to do it by hand, the Laplace and so
on. Well, what is the issue? Can you look at the Geiger values?
No.
Some of them is less system, or all of them are not?
It's R charges?
Yes.
They're all less than 2.
All less than 2?
Yes, because when you put in the superpotential, they have to sum up to 2.
Oh, okay. I see. So the main relevant.
Well, but these are just the R charges of the bifundamental field. So these are not gauge invariant operators.
Oh, sorry. I'm asking variants. Sorry, these are I'm asking variants.
Well, the variants are just multiplying them by n, by factor of n.
Right. Okay. So I've never. Less than. If n is less, small.
Yeah, I mean, if n. No, if you also include n in this game, then you have to look at what n does. But I've been putting n always to 1, more or less, for the sake of the game. For instance, yeah, you see here. There is the only place where NN, I guess, arises. So there are charges of the variance, or N times the R charges of the variance.
So in some cases, you can have R charge equal to 2 or less than 2. For some small.
If you put N to 1, I mean, if you forget about N, no, you can't have that. If you put N, I'm not sure. I'm not familiar, we can discuss this later. Some other question. Okay. Okay, so we have learned some things in this story already. Hopefully we'll learn more. But this one thing we have learned is that it seems quite magical that you start with some toric singularity, and then you come up, eventually you can go around this long loop and complete essentially the volumes of these manifolds. So this is what I mean. Okay. So this diagram here, because you start with the toric singularity, which is encoded in some vectors VI. You can start the gauge theory. If you're good enough, you can do that. And then you compute this A maximization. So you take the trial R symmetry. So the charge A will depend parametrically on this VR because the quiver depends. You do A maximization, so you can compute the X at R symmetry. You plug it back here, and then you get the center charge. And as I've written several times, the center charge is basically proportional to 1 over the volume. So given a toric singularity, you do all this work, and you can compute the volume of these manifolds. And you don't know the metric. Let's see if you can do this. So there's another question, which is, let's forget about ABS-CFT. And is there a geometrical way to obtain these volumes starting from here? So just jump directly from here to here, that would be interesting. So the question is, can we compute these volumes even in dark over the matrix? So you can immediately say, well, this is maybe this is already known. Why would you bother doing that? Well, I want to be precise. So in fact, again, this is known if the manifold is regular, which, as I explained, it's a just very fortunate case, which doesn't occur many times. So in five dimensions, you can do this essentially for the sphere and T11, and you don't know what to do otherwise. So the reason why it works is pretty easy to see, because the volume of the full space decomposes, factorizes into the volume of the father and the volume of the Keller-Einstein, and this latter volume is just given by a topological number. So essentially, the Keller-Einstein condition relates the metric to the Ricci tensor, which essentially means that this J is proportional to C1. And so the volume is given by C1 to C1, which is J by J. So that's why you can do this. But for a regular case, there is no Keller Einstein, so there is no C1. So what do you do? Okay, you don't even. So you want to have a, given the intuition from what happened with A maximization, you want to, you might think that there is an extremal problem that upon solving that, you can find these volumes. And that's going to be the case, in fact. But the first question is what is this extremization taking place over? And the key is the existence of this R real vector, which is the dual of the R symmetry, for the reason which I've anticipated at the beginning of the talk, which is the Killing spinors, so the 3.04, and in particular, so the Killing spinors are charged, so they're not, if you take the lead derivative along this vector, it's different from zero, which means they correspond to the R symmetry. Okay, so this is the, this object is the key. So because in the A maximization, we want to know the exact R symmetry, here I want to translate the problem, and I want to know the exact fortunas, the real vector. To do that, I have to do a little bit of work, slightly enlarge the space of geometries which I'm looking at. I won't give you any detail of that. Of course, if you're interested, we can talk later. But the basic idea is that you consider now the space of Sasakian metrics, which means you relax the cone now. It's not anymore Calabi-Yau, it's not anymore Ricci flat, although it's still Keeler. So you relax that condition, but you do it in a way, I mean, by definition, if still Sasakian geometries admit real vectors. So you have now some, to any Keeler metric, there is a particular real vector, okay? And here is the picture of what I want to do, okay? So I start with the toric singularity, which means there is a, I want to discuss toric manifolds, which means there is a T3, U1 to the 3. So you take a basis in three dimensions, okay, as given by this picture here, this is a basis. And you parameterize your real vector K in terms of this basis, D by the phi R. Okay? So it turns out you can show that one component of this free vector is always fixed. You can show this in different ways, but this is essentially because this direction is the one which corresponds to the trial one in the emphasization, which is the one which is always charged. So by Keeler symmetry plane, I mean that these two directions are not charged. So you must have this direction to mix with, otherwise the symmetry which you compose is not an R symmetry. So you must always have that direction, and then compose with some, just as a vector, some of vectors with these two other directions. Okay? So you vary in this plane, and you want to know what is, which is the finally the true R symmetry. So I give you the answer for that. You define a function which is called Z, which is a function of these three real numbers, and you minimize it. You just take the derivative from 2 to 0. So while you do that, Well, that, this is, you do that because this Z corresponds to the Einstein interaction particles. So putting this to zero quite remarkably, you can in fact integrate out to complete the matrix, all the information of the matrix. You don't have to do that. You just have to know about the speed. And you put it to zero, and this corresponds to the Einstein. Now please don't think that I'm gonna write down Einstein matrix now, because I can't do that. But I can write down arbitrary read vectors. And this is enough. Once you have the read vector, you can plug in back exactly as you did for maximization, and you obtain the problem. So now this diagram now, which is the dual of the diagram before, you start with the toric similarity, you do this minimization, you extract this exact read vector, you plug it back into the volumes.
Sorry, how do you define this Z function Z?
Function Z.
What's the definition of it?
It's essentially this Einstein input term. You just evaluate, and it turns out that, okay, I can give you some more detail. I just didn't want to go into the technicalities because you have to introduce some syntactic potentials and so on, but maybe I can summarize. So, remember, I've shown that every toric symplectic manifold is essentially encoded by in these diagrams. Okay, so it's interesting that if you have a read vector here, you have a plane. So now you cut this the scene into plane, and you obtain something which is now finite, a finite object. Okay, so now let's call this delta. Okay, you can show that the volume of the manifold Y is essentially up to factors of pi cubed, given by this volume of delta. And similarly, the volume of these faces, so the area of the triangles, so the volume of the supersymmetric cycles is given by pi and then volume of the faces. Okay, this is step one. Step two is to take the Einstein interaction. So you take this one, square root of g, integrate over y, r plus lambda. Okay, and you show that in fact there are some formula that you show that this is given by essentially the sum over the faces of the volume of the phase minus, say, the volume of the delta. Okay, so this is that. So now your Z depends on the volumes of the spaces, and by definition, these volumes are just specified by these vectors Vi. So this is the vector of the eye to each phase.
So this S can be viewed as type 2B compact to by the radius phi? Just leaving out the internal.
No, better compact to phi on the Z Einstein.
No, it's Y. This is an integral over Y.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, you mean 2 radius phi, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, 2 radius phi. So you look at the internal part.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, this is just the Einstein interaction for the five-dimensional internal part.
Right. So lambda is basically induced by radius phi.
Yes, it's okay. The same cosmological constant in radius phi.
Ah, okay.
Which appears on the internal part of the different sign.
Okay, that fixes the lambda. Okay.
Yeah. So lambda is it's proportional to the Ramon by plus. So, well, there are some technicalities. I mean, this is not obvious that you start with this action, and you can rewrite this in terms of this. Oh, by the way, you see that this Z also depends on the read vector, because the plane depends on the read vector. So you move this, as you move this plane, you tilt this plane here. That's where you're maximizing. So you want to move this plane roughly to make this volume minimum. Thank you. And then you can see that you recover many of the, all of the features of A maximization. For instance, the volumes are always as direct numbers and so on. So now you can take any singularity and you can compute the central charge essentially in 5 minutes. And I'll show you even the final transparency, which is an example. So this is an example for the so-called suspended pinch point singularity. But I make a rapid comparison between this Z minimization and A minimization. Okay, so this is a, again, without any entering into the details, but the singularity is encoded in this two-dimensional diagram, which corresponds to one of these three-dimensional ones. Okay. And the trial ring vector is parameterized by x, y, and t. So it's probably RT. I also explained before, in fact, one of these directions is fixed. So let's say x is equal to 3. So you can reduce now the problem to two-dimensional problem. So you take this function, and here is a plot of the function to show you the picture of what's going on. So basically, these regions, which you see where this function diverges to infinity, they correspond to the wall, to this wall, to this region. And you see that inside the function is nice and smooth and convex, and therefore it has a unique minimum. So you can evaluate this minimum, you plug it back, and you change the volume of the metric on the boundary of this suspension. Of course, this metric is not known. However, its volume is now known. You can make a check. You can do the same thing now in the gate, going to this longer diagram which I've shown before, going to constructing the quiver, which gives you this one. It's now 3-gauge loops and so on. You construct a trial A function, which is this one, and these particles are meant to be different from these particles, and nothing to do. Of course, they are related somehow, but they're not the same, you know, not the same variables. And you obtain this cubic function of, let's see, four variables with many terms and so on. You maximize this function, you plug it back, and you obtain the central charge, which, using the ADS-CT formula, gives you back this one. So you're doing two different problems. Here you're minimizing this function, and you're maximizing this function, and there is, I mean, apparently there's nothing to do one with the other. And yet obtain the same result. And this is arguably much shorter because, I mean, of course, you want to construct the quiver, it's a different story. But if you just want to know the center charge, given these points, which are parameterized here inside, these points essentially are these numbers, two, et cetera, how they appear in the function. You do that and you reproduce. There are other features which are, for instance, the fact that the maximization. In this case, minimization always takes place into two variables. That's expected because you start with a three-dimensional, with a T3, right? So you have U1 cross U1 cross U1. Okay, so you want to mix an R with an R tribe plus, say, R1 and R2. And these are this one, R1 and R2. You do this maximization, so you extract one linear combination, and the remaining two, so you are left with a U1 R, the fourth max, because it could be not compact, and a U1 cross U1 flavor. Okay? Of course, this group can be bigger, as it's the case for YPQ. For instance, this can be a better set as U2 and so on. But still, this group will always exist. So I think, in fact, I'll stop here and take any questions.
So do you have some more questions for Jeremy? At some point, there was mentioning in the beginning that the manifold is five-dimensional and it's S2 cross S3. Mm-hmm. Is this a local statement?
No, that's a global statement.
Global statement, so it's a trivial vibration.
Yes.
First order.
Like for the T1.
Okay.
Yeah, good point.
So the connection of mirror symmetry on these spaces, or is the mirror dual of cone and the mirror of the cone?
I think that the mirror dual of the cone is something longer cone.
Okay.
Yeah. You can take the, you know, you can take the exact mirror symmetry of these just in terms of these vectors. Yeah, and that's useful if you want to also understand something about some features about the fibers. However, in that case, the mirror is not anymore cone. But yeah, I mean, there are some things to probably to be understood in several directions, and mirror symmetry for these guys is something which perhaps would be nice to think about.
Can you show that these two processes always give the like, same answer, or in examples, well, maybe they don't always?
Yes, if you believe ABS-15, I can show that.
Oh.
If you believe that ABS-15, meaning that A is one of the volume, then they give always, by construction, they always give the same result. That's the point. I mean, we don't want something which works just in examples. We want something which is general.
But yeah, but the process looks similar. You want to define which arsenic degree is the right.
Yeah. Well, I think it's much more than similar. The non-trivial part, which is something I'm thinking about and investigating, is that these two functions, A and Z, are really different. And at the end of the day, it must be the same effect. However, regardless of the details of how these functions look like, if you extremize them and you evaluate at the extrema point, and you believe, I mean, take this ABS-CFT formula, they give the same value. Quite
I see. So before minimization, extremization A is not really corresponding to Z in geometric side.
No.
One cannot find something weak for that's like one more volume, right? So can we just start with just the volume itself in the box side?
That's what you are doing, but that's the volume of the metric which is not Einstein. Okay. You have to enlarge the space
right
in order to take the derivative, say roughly. In order to take the derivative, you want to have something which is not in the point, you have to have an open set. So you enlarge it in order to have some Sasaki metrics, which are not anymore Einstein. And that takes values into the space. Okay, so now you might ask, it's a good question, what does this, does it correspond to anything? This enlarged functional in the gauge theory? I don't know exactly.
Both A is related to the anomaly, right, in the gauge theory side?
Yes.
So exactly. Can one find an analogous object in the point side?
Okay, this can't be exactly the same. Okay, they are going to coincide with four dimensions, but this can't be exactly the same process because another interesting fact is that the results that I've been discussing for this Z are true in any dimension.
Ah, I see, okay.
Okay, so in particular, it's interesting that they are true for when you take Sasaki Einstein to be seven dimensional. So that means that this process implies using ABS-CFT that n equals 2 superconformal theories, well, let's say toric, obey the same thing. However, there is no maximization for these theories.
Right.
Okay? There are no anomalies, three-dimensional conformal theories. But the results we have, I think, suggest that there is, in fact, something similar. I mean, some A theorem, something which is also true in three dimensions.
So for the original ABS-CFT correspondence, I had an ABS 5 equals S 5.
Yes.
It corresponds to n equals 4 polynomials,
yes.
Right? So this theory would correspond to lower.
Yes, n equals 1.
N equals 1, what is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
N equals 1 to the conformals, which is 8 super.
Okay.
Well, if there are no further questions, let's thank Mario again. And just to remind people, our afternoon.